Shalom, welcome to the Jewish Task Force, JTF. My name is Chaim Ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to refuah shlema, complete recovery. For Sharon Katz, Shlomo Ben Sara, Malka Bat Allegra, Helen Friedman, Dorit Bat Sara, and Shifra Bat Sara, and elevating the souls of Daniel Neinkin, Allegra Bat Rachel, Pesach Zeb Ben Chava, Harav Meir Kahana, Yosef Ben Meir, Bari Hoffman, Dennis Shore, Ruven Hoffman, Robert Mittman, and Tzipora Fegi Bat Liba. This week we want to discuss why the forces of evil are taking over America, and if they succeed, which they probably will, that will lead to the destruction of America. And why the forces of evil are succeeding, why they're winning, and they've been winning for quite a while now. And when I speak about the forces of evil, I'm speaking about groups like Black Lives Matter and all the black Nazis with their hatred and their envy of whites in general and Jews in particular. And I'm speaking about the sodomites, the homosexual perverts with their abominable behavior and abominable lifestyle and the perversion that they're wreaking upon America and how they're destroying all of America's moral values. And I'm speaking about the communists, the socialists, all the self-hating whites and self-hating Jews and just disgusting people, fifth columnists that want to impose an agenda that would absolutely destroy the United States, that has destroyed every society in every country where it has been imposed, and it would have the same impact on the United States. But why are all of these forces, black Nazis, sodomites, communists, why are they taking over? Why are they winning? Why are they winning so decisively? Why are real conservatives unable to get a foothold anywhere? That's the question. Now, first of all, let me just state that the reason they're winning is because they are uncompromising and committed to their cause, their evil cause, but they're committed to it, and they're uncompromising. And when someone is uncompromising and with perseverance continues and continues and continues and doesn't give up and keeps fighting and fighting and fighting, eventually they're going to win, especially if their opponents are compromising, are giving in, are constantly trying to work out deals, are never standing up for their principles, which is what you have on the right and what you have with the Americans who oppose these forces of evil. They're constantly bending over backwards and compromising and caving in. In a situation like that, inevitably, the forces that don't compromise will win. They will win in the end. The practical, moderate, sensible people, the Republicans and conservatives who say you have to be practical, you have to be pragmatic, and those people never win historically. In the long term, they always lose. And even if they take power, they'll wind up screwing the country as well. They'll sell out the country and screw the country as well. Only people with true principles who persevere win historically in the end. They're the ones who win. Now, this is something that Donald Trump understood to a certain extent when he ran for president, because he started out running for president. And he was fortunate in that the left-wing news media supported him very strongly when he ran for president. He was a terrible candidate. But he ran in a race with 17 Republicans. He was running against 16 others. There were 17 candidates for the Republican presidential nomination in 2016. And the media promoted Donald Trump day and night. I don't know if you remember 2015, 2016. Day and night, 24-hour wall-to-wall coverage of Donald Trump, Donald Trump, Donald Trump. I don't believe there has ever been a time in American history when an individual got so much media attention and so much coverage. And of course, in a situation like that, where he's making the statements that he's making, and the media is covering him, and the left is attacking him, of course the Republicans are going to rally around him, and the other 16 Republican candidates get no attention, are shut out, get very little attention. So of course, in a situation like that, he's going to win. The media wanted him to win because they thought for sure he would lose in the November election against Hillary Clinton. So they wanted Trump to win, and so they promoted him and promoted him and promoted him. And Ted Cruz, they didn't want, because they saw Ted Cruz had a Reagan-esque ability to speak. Ted Cruz is a fantastic orator and a great debater and a brilliant leader. And he is, Ted Cruz is uncompromising. Donald Trump is uncompromising when it comes to his own personal interests. He's uncompromising when it comes to promoting himself. Not promoting the interests of the country, because he will betray the country in order to promote Donald Trump, in order to promote his own interests. But in promoting his own interests, he is uncompromising, and he has won some amazing victories by being uncompromising, because that does work. It does work when you persevere. I'm not saying that you should do it in a way that's foolish. Obviously, you have to have a certain level of pragmatism and a certain level of practicality and a certain level of a certain ability to adjust to various changing situations. Of course you have to have that. You have to have a certain amount of flexibility and maneuverability in pursuing the tactics that you pursue in any battle, in any war. But when your overall ideology and direction and vision is uncompromising, and you don't diverge from your overall goal, and you continue to hammer away at certain principles and certain views, in the end, historically, those are the people that actually change history. And Donald Trump, he took an ideology, he took certain ideology in the Republican Party and in the conservative movement, and ran with it, even though it went against everything that he stood for his whole life. His whole life he was a liberal Democrat. He supported amnesty for illegal aliens. He supported gay marriage. He supported supported abortion, including partial birth abortion, murder of babies right up until the time of conception. This was the real Donald Trump his whole life. But he realized that he can't continue to do that and get the Republican nomination for president. So he changed his views on all of this and ran a campaign that pleased Republicans, and stupid Republicans nominated him instead of Ted Cruz, who would have been the real deal. The media wanted Trump over Cruz very badly and smothered Cruz out of the picture and shut him up. Despite that, to show how effective Cruz was as a candidate, he still came in a strong second. Out of 17 candidates, Ted Cruz came in a strong second, even though the media ignored him and trashed him and everybody trashed him and everybody was against him. And still, he came in a strong second. So obviously, if you didn't have this media overflow, and if Republicans had just a slight amount of brains, Ted Cruz would have been the Republican nominee, would have been a great Republican president, and really would have changed history in a positive way. But instead, we wound up getting Donald Trump. But again, Donald Trump proved that he didn't do it because of principles concerning America. He did it to promote himself, because on that he is uncompromising on promoting himself. But still, the fact that he perseveres and fights to promote himself and doesn't give in and doesn't give an inch, that also leads to a certain level of success. And so he was able to win the presidency in a surprise victory in 2016. But as president, he's pursued in a half-hearted way certain policies to limit immigration in a half-hearted way. And make other limitations. He still supports affirmative action. His administration promotes affirmative action, which is vicious, institutionalized, racist discrimination against whites, Jews, Asians. That his administration has continued, that evil policy. His administration continues to support the gay agenda a little bit less maybe than Obama did, but overall they support that agenda. And his administration does nothing about the scourge of abortion, does nothing about these other moral issues. On Israel, the Trump plan in the Middle East is a terrible plan, would create a so-called Palestinian state, which is national suicide for Israel. He has pressured Israel not to build Jewish communities in Judea, Samaria, and Jerusalem, and Bibi Netanyahu has wholeheartedly embraced that pressure and used that as a reason not to build and to have a building freeze. So he's done some terrible things. He did get out of the Iran nuclear agreement, but he has not destroyed Iran's nuclear bomb-making program. That threat continues to hover over the world. And we may still have a nuclear Iran and the possible prospect of a nuclear Holocaust, God forbid, and a nuclear arms race among all the Muslim countries in the Middle East, which would be an unbelievable nightmare. That prospect still exists under Donald Trump. Because, again, what he has done has been half-hearted. He doesn't have the guts to have the U.S. Air Force go in and destroy Iran's nuclear program, which could be done, by the way, in less than 24 hours with no American casualties. But he hasn't had the guts to do that. He doesn't understand how that can be done. He thinks if you attack Iran, you got to go in and invade. He's so ignorant and stupid. He's such a clownish orange buffoon. He doesn't even know that it would be a simple military surgical operation. That's all America needs to do in Iran. Just like what Israel did against Saddam Hussein's nuclear program in Iraq. Just like what Israel did against Syria's nuclear program. Just like what the United States did against Saddam Hussein's nuclear program in the Persian Gulf War. There are many other instances where this has been done already, where there's a precedent for this. The United States Air Force can easily carry this out. But anyway, he doesn't have the understanding or the knowledge to do what has to be done. Ted Cruz did. Unfortunately, we're stuck with Donald Trump. And Donald Trump, the reason we support Donald Trump for re-election, despite all the criticism you're hearing about him from me, we support him for re-election because, as we've said many times, he's the lesser of the evils, of course, but also because he has slowed down the destruction of America and has slowed down things that the Democrats would speed up. Under the Democrats, these terrible trends and terrible things that are happening would happen much faster, and the pressure on Israel would be much greater, and the attempt to get Israel to commit national suicide would be much more pronounced, and there'd be a much greater concentration on it. And in America, the destructive programs, again, would be accelerated. So under the Democrats, there's no question they're worse. And so we have to support Trump for re-election, even though because of his buffoonish, stupid, ignorant behavior, I don't think he's going to get re-elected. I hope he does. I hope I'm wrong. But I think he probably, I don't know for sure, of course. There could be surprises like there was in 2016. But I don't think he's going to get re-elected. The polls show him way behind. The American people, most Americans are very dissatisfied with the way things are going. They don't like his leadership style. So we've got a real problem. But again, we have to understand that when you have no apologies and no compromise and stand for principle and are not afraid to offend people, which Trump is willing to do to defend himself personally, and for certain things he's been willing to do that. Certain things he has been willing to do that. That is the key to success. Unfortunately, he hasn't done that in a broad way with all of his policies. If he had done that in a broad way with all of his policies, which is what Ted Cruz would have done, then we would have a very different situation in this country. The country would be in much better shape. But anyway, the left and the evil people, the news media, the black Nazis, and when I say black Nazis, why do I call them black Nazis? Because they support Louis Farrakhan. All the black leaders in this country support all the black leaders who are Democrats, who are representing 97-98% of black America. They support Louis Farrakhan, who has said that Hitler was a great man and Judaism is a gutter religion and the Jews deserve another Holocaust and the Jews are termites and all these, and they should be exterminated, and all these other things that he said, the white race is going to be exterminated, and Allah is going to exterminate the white race. Hitler was a great man. Hitler was a very great man. I like when the Jews call Farrakhan Hitler. Hitler was a great man. That was one of Farrakhan's statements in Chicago. And then he said, there is a spaceship called the Mothership flying over the United States, which is going to suck up the whole white race as soon as Allah give the signal. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad, he be the captain of this spaceship. This is the type of thing, this is the type of insanity that he teaches the ignorant, low IQ, gorilla-faced criminals who are part of what he calls the Fruit of Islam, his organization, the Nation of Islam, or the Fruit of Islam. And Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, Barack Hussein Obama have all attended his rallies and support him and back him up. Obama attended Farrakhan's Million Man March in 1995. Obama supports Farrakhan. They hate white people. They hate Jews, even though the Jews are the ones who supported them and backed them and continue to back them, unfortunately. But black, so why do I call blacks Nazis? Because they themselves praise Hitler, support genocide, have a view of white, a racial view on whites, and an anti-Semitic view on Jews that is true Nazism in every sense of the word. It's black Nazism. And I'm not, and again, I reiterate this all the time, I'm not referring to everybody who is black, because I don't care about the color of someone's skin. It doesn't interest me at all. But when black people, when 97% of black people declare war against my people, the Jewish people, then you better believe I'm going to respond. I'm not like these self-hating Jewish cowards who get down on their hands and knees to their enemies. I am going to respond. And I'm going to call it for what it is. And they're taking over. They're taking over. They have captured the entire agenda. They have their white allies and their Jewish allies in the news media and Hollywood, everywhere else, and they're taking over. They're seizing control of the country. And again, it's because of a willingness not to compromise. The one Jewish leader that understood this concept of how you have to persevere and how you have to remain devoted to principle, real principles, and a really true Torah agenda for Jews, it should be a Torah agenda, God-fearing agenda. The one leader that really understood this in our time, the only leader that really understood it, was our leader, our beloved rabbi, Harav Meir David Kahana Zecher Tzadik VeKadosh Livracha Hashem Yikom Damo. Our great Rabbi Meir Kahana of blessed memory, may God avenge his blood. Rabbi Kahana understood that, and he applied this principle when he formed the Jewish Defense League, which I had the honor of being the national chairman of the JDL during the peak of our campaign to free Soviet Jewry. He applied this principle to free the Jews in the Soviet Union. This was at a time when the JDL started its campaign to free Soviet Jews. No Jews were getting out. From 1917 to 1968, almost no Jews got out. Only very elderly, a few hundred elderly Jews would get out. And there was no Jewish immigration. And the Soviets denied that the Jews wanted to leave. And the world knew that there was an issue here, that there was a problem here, but Jews didn't give a damn. They were so busy sucking up to all of their enemies and being freaking low-life, self-hating, Judenrat cowards, that they didn't do anything for the Jews in the Soviet Union, just like they didn't do anything for the Jews during the Holocaust, when over 6 million Jews were burned and gassed in the worst crime in human history. American Jews did nothing to save them and could have stopped the Holocaust easily if they had done 1% of what they did on behalf of black Nazis during the so-called civil rights movement. They could have easily stopped the Holocaust. They could have forced the United States to bomb the rail lines leading to Auschwitz, to destroy the concentration camps, stop the Holocaust dead in its tracks, and the Nazis were afraid of what would happen after the war. They were afraid. They thought nothing will happen to them and everything will be fine, because they saw the world didn't give a damn as they were murdering the Jews, and the world was enabling them to do it. But if there had been a complete concentrated effort to stop it and prevent the Holocaust, that would have, the Germans would have stopped their extermination campaign, would have been physically unable to carry it out, and would have wanted to stop it, because they were afraid of what would happen after the war. And we know that because Raoul Wallenberg, the great Swedish hero, a righteous Gentile, Alav HaShalom, may he rest in peace. The great Raoul Wallenberg, when he threatened the Nazis in Hungary and said, "You're going to be tried and hanged as war criminals after the war if you touch any Jews," they stopped touching the Jews then. They stopped, and they let him rescue Jews when that happened. Now, Rabbi Kahana, though, understood that the Jews have this curse. It's called respectability. Jews are so concerned about, and white people in general, when I'm speaking about Jews here, the whites in general have the same insane behavior. But I'm addressing my fellow Jews here because this is a Jewish program and a Jewish organization. But this is a true issue for whites in general in America. They have to be respectable. They have to do things respectably. They have to say the N-word. They're not allowed to say the word nigger, even if the people who are going to be called nigger deserve to be called nigger. They're not allowed to say, they have to say the N-word. Every other group we can say kikes, we can say spics, we can say guineas, we can say mix, we can say things against white people, anything, any insult, anything you want for any group. But for niggers, it's the N-word. You're not allowed to say nigger. And again, I don't go around calling anyone who's black a nigger, because I'm not against people because of their race. I'm against the majority of blacks in America because of their evil, Nazi, jealous, violent, hateful, ignorant culture. That's why I'm against them. But I'm not against them because of their race, and the minority of blacks that are not like that, I have nothing against them at all. Nothing against them. And this is not, and they're not part of the criticism that I'm leveling at blacks who support Farrakhan. I'm making it very clear which blacks I'm against. The Farrakhan, Obama, Jackson, Sharpton, Congressional Black Caucus, NAACP, National Association for the Annihilation of Caucasian People. Those are the blacks that I'm against. And that is the overwhelming majority. But that small minority of blacks that are not like that, I have nothing against them at all. Of course not. Now, Rabbi Kahana understood that he has to get attention on the issue of Soviet Jewry in order to prevent Soviet Jews from being destroyed like the Jews were destroyed during the Holocaust. In the Soviet Union, they were being destroyed by forcible assimilation. Jews who wanted to practice Judaism were being sent to Siberian concentration camps. Judaism was forcibly suppressed. And so the Jews were disappearing because it was against the law to learn Hebrew. It was against the law. It was in effect against the law to pray, to go to synagogue and pray. To have any Jewish identity was against the law. And so Soviet Jews were going to disappear. We were going to lose them all. Rabbi Kahana understood that we desperately have to save them, and we can't allow what happened during the Holocaust to be repeated with Soviet Jews. And so, in 1969, he started a campaign to free Soviet Jews. And it was only when JDL started the campaign that Soviet Jews started to get out. In the 70s, they started to get out only because of the JDL. There's no question that it was the JDL that got them out. And Jewish leaders admitted that it was the JDL that got the Soviet Jews out. Jewish leaders admitted this. I had debates with Jewish leaders who admitted that it was the JDL. If not for the JDL, they wouldn't be acting on the issue of Soviet Jewry. And so JDL served as a catalyst to push all American Jews to act on this issue. And JDL understood in order to get something done on this issue, you've got to get a lot of attention. That means you've got to do outrageous things. Outrageous things get attention, because we didn't have a big budget. We didn't have a lot of money. We didn't have support from Jewish establishment groups and from Hollywood and the media. They were all against us. And so in order to get somewhere, we had to do outrageous things. The first outrageous thing that I ever did was when I was 15 years old. Rabbi Kahana had a policy of stopping Soviet cultural events. The Soviet ballet, Soviet groups would come here for dancing and for music and other things. And they'd go to Lincoln Center and all in Madison Square Garden and all these other places and perform for American audiences. Now, they weren't doing this because they want Americans to enjoy their culture. They were doing this for propaganda purposes, because Americans who would leave those Soviet performances and who were impressed by those Soviet performances, Americans who would leave impressed and actually enjoyed the performances, would leave saying, they can't be so bad. Look how nicely they sing and dance, and look at the culture and everything else. They can't be so bad. It can't be true what they say about what happens in the Soviet Union. Rabbi Kahana said, we have to put an end to that. And by the way, let me just state, when the Soviet Union ultimately fell in 1989, 1990, and then you had Russia and it broke apart into different countries, the Jews still wouldn't have gotten out, because the same bureaucrats controlled the visa offices and the immigration offices. You still needed a visa to get out. They had to issue you a visa. The communist officials who were in charge in the Soviet Union were also in charge in Russia later when Yeltsin was president. And so they wouldn't have issued visas to the Jews. They still would have refused to let them go, because they wanted the Jews to stay in Russia. Of course they wanted the Jews to stay in Russia. The Jews were the brains of Russia. They were 50% of the scientists, 50% of the inventors and the professors, even though they were only 1% of the population. So of course they wanted the Jews to stay. They wouldn't have let the Jews out. Even after the fall of the Soviet Union, they were not going to let the Jews out. They weren't going to issue visas. And the world would have done nothing. No one would have done anything. There would have been complete silence. They would have said, it's a tragedy, it's unfortunate. And people would occasionally have spoken about it in some Jewish newspaper on page 38 of some Jewish newspaper. But it would have been no big deal. That's what would have happened. That's what always happens when there's injustice against Jews. If the Jews don't fight back and don't do something about it. And that's what would have happened if not for the JDL. But they couldn't ignore the issue and do that with the Jews. Because the JDL got involved and decided the Soviets want good relations with the United States. They need trade with the United States. Their economy is in terrible shape. They need technology transfers. They need all these other things. We're going to disrupt everything they're trying to do with the United States and disrupt and worsen their relationship with the United States and say, unless you free Soviet Jews, you're not going to get anything. You're not going to have any type of relationship with the United States. We're going to make sure your relationship is very bad. And that the Soviets didn't want and couldn't afford. And so the JDL strategy was actually a brilliant strategy. Rabbi Kahana was a genius, and the strategy was a brilliant strategy. And it was based upon understanding Soviet interests. But he knew that in order to do that, we had to do outrageous things. First of all, we had to get massive attention so that everybody would know that the issue exists and that there's a problem with Soviet Jews. It had to become an issue. Just like the phony so-called Palestinian issue became an issue because of Arab terrorism. And just like Black Lives Matter becomes an issue because of rioting and murder and all the other things, black violence. That's really what makes it an issue. And so Rabbi Kahana understood that Jews have to do outrageous things and have to be willing to offend people if necessary, but have to make sure that that issue makes page one of the newspapers and is the number one broadcast on television. There was no internet in those days, but it becomes the number one story. He understood that we have to do that. We have to make sure every American knows that there's an issue as far as Soviet Jewry, because that's the Soviets don't want Americans to know about it. They want to keep this as secretive as possible. And so, how did he do that? Well, I was mentioning that the Soviets had a cultural program where they would bring in performers and dancers. And so they had something called Soviet ice skating. Leningrad ice skaters came in to perform at Madison Square Garden. And Rabbi Kahana, they knew most of the JDL people, the FBI and the police knew the JDL people. They were at the entrance to protect these performers. So how can we get in? So Rabbi Kahana saw that I was a 15-year-old kid. And much to my sorrow, I looked like I was 12 years old. Very embarrassing. People would say, how old are you, 12, 13? And I was 15. Very embarrassing. And that continued, by the way, later on, even when I was in my 20s, people thought I was a teenager. Very, very embarrassing. People who are young know what I mean. Now that you're older, you think, what's wrong with that? No. Believe me, when you're young, you want to look more mature. You don't want to look younger. It was embarrassing. But anyway, I looked like I was 12 or 13 year. I looked like a 12 or 13 year old kid. I was 15. And Rabbi Kahana, I'm 64 now. I'm going to be 64 in December. I'm going to be 64 years old now. So just to give you a perspective on the time frame here. And Rabbi Kahana said, he asked me if I'm willing to go in and disrupt the Soviet ice skating. And I said I would. I said I'd go in. And so I went in with a big bag of marbles. I went in with a knapsack and a big bag of marbles. And they were searching certain people. They were in the front searching. They would pull certain people out and search someone who looked suspicious as they were going in. The police were there. The FBI was there. They didn't recognize me. They didn't know me at the time when I was 15. I had never been arrested before. This was my first action. And I went inside. And I immediately joined a group from Ohio, of tourists from Ohio. And they were taking pictures, and I took a picture in front, waving like I'm part of the group. And it looked like I fit in with the kids from Ohio. So I was one of the kids from Ohio, and they weren't searching the kids from Ohio. So I got inside with the marbles, and with a bag of marbles. And the ice skaters are skating. It started, and as soon as they started, I ran up on the stage. I ran up out of my seat, ran up on the stage all of a sudden, pulled out and ripped open the bag of marbles and spilled the marbles on the stage. And the lead male ice skater, he got nervous when he saw that. He didn't know, because the JDL at that time had a reputation of bombing. And we had some, Rabbi Kahana deliberately made sure we had a reputation of being really violent, crazy terrorists, because he knew that would work in favor of our campaign to free Soviet Jews. The Soviets didn't want to have to deal with crazy people who are going to do crazy things that will hurt Soviet-American relations, that will force the Soviets to complain about what happened to their diplomats or their performers, and it will hurt Soviet-American relations. Rabbi Kahana knew that, and so he wasn't concerned about whether people liked the JDL or whether JDL was popular. He was interested. Of course, he would have preferred if JDL was popular. Of course he would have. But he was willing to sacrifice popularity to save the Jewish people. And so I went in, I ripped the bag of marbles open, marbles spilling all over the ice, and the Soviet ice skater, he was making some sort of move on the ice when he saw that, and it caused him sort of to panic. So he fell on the ice and sprained, and he hurt his ankle badly, or sprained his ankle. I don't know what exactly it was. But they ended up canceling all their performances. First, they canceled that performance, and they ended up canceling all their other performances in Philadelphia, Boston, Washington. They were supposed to perform all over the country. They canceled it all. And bitterly complained to the American authorities, why don't you protect us? What is this? What's going on here? And it was hurting Soviet-American relations. And I got a beating at the time. The police and the FBI grabbed me, and they worked me over. And I went, because I was 15 years old, it was nothing. It turned into nothing. There were no real legal consequences in those days. Everybody was super, super lenient with juveniles. And they knew this was for the Jewish cause. And what is he, spilling marbles on the ice? 15-year-old kid, no priors, no prior record. Nothing happened. But anyway, my family heard about it, and they were in shock. Depends which part of my family we're talking about. My parents were supportive. My parents were usually supportive of me. I had wonderful parents always, and very good Jews. My parents are very good Jews. But I had other people in my family, I don't want to say who, but other relatives who were super respectable, very wealthy. My family's not wealthy. My parents and we're not wealthy. We never cared about money. Anybody who knows me knows that I don't have a lot of money. But I had relatives who were super successful, multimillionaires, and this is in the early 70s. Being a multimillionaire then was really something, and very, very successful people, very big machers in the community. And they decided to set up a meeting for me with someone from the American Jewish Committee. And the person from the American Jewish Committee explained to me, yes, we want to protest the mistreatment of Soviet Jews, and yes, you want people to be aware of it, but you're going to turn everybody off. When you disrupt cultural performances, they're going to say, what are you, you're against culture? You don't do that. You're turning everybody off to your cause. It's counterproductive. You're just going to hurt your cause. You're just going to rouse sympathy for the other side. You don't do things like that. That's the worst thing you can do. So I was a 15-year-old kid, and they really told me this, and there was a professor there, and there was an attorney there, and there was someone from the American Jewish Committee there with my family. They got all these people to come and speak to me. And so I was confused. A 15-year-old kid, I didn't know the answers. I just wanted to help Soviet Jews. I didn't want there to be another Holocaust. I wanted to help Soviet Jews. I wanted to say never again, that never again would our people go through this type of persecution. Never again would we be silent when this happens. So I didn't know what to do. So then I went down to the JDL headquarters after that meeting, because I was confused. And I went down to the JDL headquarters on New Utrecht Avenue. They had a big headquarters at that time on New Utrecht Avenue in Brooklyn. And I asked Rabbi Kahana if I could speak to him. And first of all, Rabbi Kahana came up and hugged me and said, wonderful what you did. Great what you did. Great job. And I said, well, can I speak to you, Rabbi? Because they said, of course. So then I told him what happened with the meeting. And I said, I don't know if we're really helping. I don't know. Is this really going to help? Everybody in my family told me you're just turning people off, including people who might be sympathetic to you and support you. So Rabbi Kahana said, first of all, we don't want sympathy. We want results. We want people to actually do something, not to say, oh, yes, yes, it's terrible. There was a Holocaust, and give us Holocaust memorials and Holocaust museums. We don't want there to be a Holocaust in the first place. That should have been the attitude. Not, thank you, oh, you're giving us a museum and you're giving us memorials. And no, we are interested in saving Jewish lives here. That's number one. Number two, what you did, he said, got a lot of publicity for the cause of Soviet Jewry. And even if people don't like what you did, and even if people, let's say, are upset that you disrupted a cultural event, ice skating, they nevertheless, in the back of their mind, will now know that there's a problem with Soviet Jewry. They're not going to hold that against Soviet Jews. They're not going to hold that against the campaign to free Soviet Jews. They're just going to hold it against you and the JDL, maybe. But they're still, in the back of their mind, now they know that there's oppression of Soviet Jews, that there's a problem with Soviet Jews. They didn't know that before. You introduced that issue to millions of people with what you did. Just as the JDL, everything the JDL did, including bombings, made hundreds of millions of people around the world, including the entire American people, aware of the fact that there was an issue with Soviet Jewry. And it became a huge thing with the JDL, with the bombings, a huge issue that was the number one story on television, and a huge issue. And that means when it's a huge issue, it's an issue that can't be ignored. And nobody can deny that what's happening to Soviet Jews is unjust. That they're not letting them out, that they're persecuting them solely because they're Jews. That's unjust. The Soviets don't want that story to get out, even if the tactics you use might turn certain people off, but they don't want that story to get out. And you put that story out to millions of people again. So what you did was good for Soviet Jews. Maybe not good for the reputation of JDL, or maybe it does turn off certain people, but it helps Soviet Jews. He said, you can choose to do whatever you want in life. You're young. You have to make choices what you want to do, if you want to be a Jewish activist, if you want to save Jews. But remember one rule, Rabbi Kahana told me. Remember one rule that we learned bitterly during the Holocaust and bitterly during 2,000 years of endless inquisitions and pogroms and persecutions of the worst type, where millions and millions of Jews were slaughtered and tortured and raped in the worst way possible for 20 centuries. We learned a very bitter lesson during that time. We learned, and especially during the Holocaust in more recent history, we learned a lesson that every Jew should understand. And that lesson is, if you really want results, if you really want to save your people, never be afraid to offend the so-called polite people when challenging injustice. You challenged injustice. You challenged wrong. You challenged the people who went to that ice skating and weren't concerned about Soviet Jews. You challenged them. And you're challenging them with every act you take to save Soviet Jewry, including outrageous acts. You're challenging injustice. And yes, it might offend them. But it is precisely outrageous acts, and precisely because it will get so much attention and offend them, that it'll make them think at least about, what am I doing now for Soviet Jews? Because you know how the Jewish organizations reacted to the things we did in the JDL when we bombed. We literally blew up Soviet offices and Soviet diplomatic cars, and Soviet cars, the cars of Soviet diplomats. We didn't kill people, but we did bombings and we did property damage and we did other things. You know how the Jewish organizations, the Jewish establishment organizations that did have real power and did have money and did have the ability to change things, you know how, and were doing nothing to save Soviet Jews, nothing. They were undermining the campaign to save Soviet Jews. And they literally undermined the campaign to save Soviet Jews when Senator Scoop Jackson from Washington proposed the Jackson-Vanik Amendment to tie Soviet-American trade to free immigration, which was certainly something that would save Soviet Jewish lives. The Jewish organizations were against him, lobbied against it, just like AIPAC, that evil self-hating organization, Yimash Shemam V'Zichram, just like they are now telling senators and congressmen to criticize Israel and say to Israel, you shouldn't have you shouldn't annex territory in Judea and Samaria. And that is what they're doing, by the way. That's what they're doing in the halls of Congress, in the aisles of Congress. You know how these Jewish organizations who were doing nothing and who were sabotaging Soviet Jewry, you know how they reacted when this became a huge issue? They condemned us ferociously, hysterically condemned us. But then they said, their members were saying to them, yeah, but what are we doing about this? Okay, you say what JDL does is bad, but what are you doing? Nothing? It's a big issue. Look at it. It's a big issue. It's all over the news. What are you doing? They were forced to do something. They held mass rallies with hundreds of thousands of Jews started holding mass rallies. The JDL forced them to do it. Jerry Goodman from the National Council on Soviet Jewry, which was the Jewish establishment umbrella group to deal with the issue. He represents B'nai B'rith, the American Jewish Congress, American Jewish Committee, UJA, AIPAC, all these groups were part of that umbrella. He debated me on television when we tear gassed the Soviet ballet at Lincoln Center in 1986, many years later. And he admitted that our actions served as a catalyst and were pushing Jewish organizations into action. He admitted that we're acting in response to what you did. He admitted it was the JDL actions that were forcing the Jewish organizations to act on Soviet Jewry. And there were many other leaders who said the same thing. So in the end, what the Jewish establishment did for Soviet Jewry, and they did finally do things, it was because of JDL. JDL forced these traitors to finally do something. I never forgot that one line of Rabbi Kahana. Never be afraid to offend the so-called polite people when challenging injustice. That's why Black Lives Matter is winning. That's why the sodomites are winning. Remember the group ACT UP, those sodomites? They said they got their tactics from the Nazis in Germany. They interrupted everybody. You know, remember they would be screaming, people are dying of AIDS! You remember that? But they got action. They got tens of billions of dollars to be spent on AIDS research and all the other research on cancer and heart disease and diabetes and all the other important diseases were pushed to the side so that they could work on this disease for the sodomites. They got action because they were not concerned about offending people. They were not concerned about whether or not it offends the so-called polite people. They wanted action, and they got action. And it's a lesson we should be learning now. It's an important lesson to be learned. We could have stopped the Holocaust. We could have changed so many other things in history if we had acted on these issues the way Rabbi Kahana had urged us to do. What a loss when Rabbi Kahana was murdered by the Al-Qaeda terrorists in 1990. What a loss that was for the Jewish people. What a blow for the Jewish people and for the world. And so, why are the forces of evil winning? Because the forces of evil don't give an inch. They don't compromise. They know how to wage an effective campaign to achieve their goals. The other side is always caving in and always compromising and always being reasonable and flexible and moderate and you have to and after all and being objective on the one hand, but then again on the other hand. This is the Jewish mental illness. On the one hand, but then again on the other hand. No. When you're fighting in a war, you can't be objective. You've got to achieve your goals, and you've got to be fully committed to victory. Victory, justice, righteousness, and truth. That's what you've got to be committed to. That's how you win battles. And unless there is a counterforce that will go against these forces of evil, and that will stand up for what is right and what is true, unless that happens, America is doomed. That's a lesson of history, and it's a lesson from the JDL and from our history in the JDL as well. Here we are with our campaign to awaken the Jews of Israel, We bring our message to them. We have an advertising campaign. We just put up another video for advertising. It's all Hebrew videos in Israel. That's what we're concentrating on now, reaching the Jews of Israel with our message. And thousands of Jews are getting our message. Thousands of Jews every week receive our message from our videos. Is it enough? No, we want millions to receive our message. But at least we're doing everything we can to bring some truth to the Jews of Israel. That's what we're focused on now, to wake them up and to create the time and pave the road for when a new leader and new movement will come forward that will work to save the Jewish people and turn the Jews into what they were meant to be, what they were destined to be, a light unto the nations and a holy nation and a nation of priests. If we work together as a team, we can make this a better world and we can change history. How do I know? Because we've done it before, and we can do it again. For JTF, until next week, this is Chaim Ben Pesach. Shalom.